Morning is a consolidated case involving State X Rel BH Media Group versus Frakes, State X Rel Lee Enterprises versus Frakes, and State X Rel Miller versus Frakes. Justice Papik is recused in this matter, so Chief Judge Moore of the Nebraska Court of Appeals is joining the court. With that in mind, Mr. Post, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court. The threshold issue in this case is whether 83-967 is an exemption statute or an exception statute. All of the parties do agree on one thing, which is that regardless of whether it's an exemption statute or an exception statute, the initial burden is on the requesting party to show the record that they are requesting is a public record. But in an exception case, the statute spells out the definition of a public record and accepts from that definition another statute. It has been described by this court as the other statute exception. 83-967 is one such exception, and it contains language that is stronger than the exception found in the Unger case, and language that is similar to language that appears in multiple other exception statutes in the Nebraska Revised Statutes. Some of those, for example,
are... What does 83-967 say? What's the exception?
It says the identity of all members of the execution team and any information reasonably calculated to lead to the identity of such members shall be confidential and exempt from disclosure pursuant to, and then it cites the public record statutes.
So what is the burden on the realtor?
In this instance, it would be just like in Unger. The requesting party has to show that with this statute that the records they're requesting are public records. After they've done that, then the burden shifts over to the public body. So here they would need to show that the information they've requested is not, it or does not contain the names of execution members, that's under the first clause, or is not reasonably calculated to lead to the identity of team members.
How would they do that?
In this case, one example that was not used was that they could seek in-camera review. They could ask the judge to look at these records. Again, that didn't happen here.
Neither party sought in-camera review, is that correct?
No, but there's a second portion of 83-967 I need to point out as we consider the in-camera review question. So first, in-camera review under the Records Act wouldn't kick in if it's another statute exception. I think you could argue for in-camera review anytime in a case, but the Records Act portion wouldn't kick in. And then if we're considering whether or not the public body should have been the entity to ask for in-camera review, we need to look at the second half of 967, which says, and shall not be subject to discovery or introduced as evidence in any civil proceeding unless extraordinary good cause is shown and a protective order is issued limiting such information. And so with that context, the legislature is telling the public body here, you're not the one that offers this. If the other side wants it, they need to get it in front of the judge somehow, some way, or they need to get some testimony before the court. They need to do something. And if this seems difficult to overcome, it's because the legislature intended for it to be that way.
Well, did the legislature intend for all of that to be that way? Mm-hmm. Wasn't there some legislation that was considered to make it even more difficult to deal with pharmacies and pharmaceutical companies and things of that nature that were suppliers of these drugs? Wasn't that considered by the legislature?
Right, and so that legislation that came later was much more expansive than the example we have here. So in that instance, it would have, well, a good example, it's been talked about in the briefs. The drug supplier in 2015 did not have knowledge of a team member. Knowing the name of the supplier in 2015 could not have possibly led to the identity of an execution team member because they didn't know one. They were located outside the United States. It simply wasn't possible. Here, the evidence in the record is that the supplier does know knowledge of the team member. Look at Frake's testimony in the record. Look at Joe Dugan's testimony. Joe Dugan's a good reporter. He says he's going to follow up and ask. That's exactly what you would expect. We know that every time a piece of information related to the death penalty is released, that every new shred of information is going to be investigated both upstream and downstream from that information.
Were there any non-disclosure agreements in the contracts between the state and the supplier?
Not that I know of, but I believe...
Would that have been one way to protect the identities of the execution team?
That, though, of course, would assume that under what we know will be immense pressure on the supplier, that supplier would forego other things in order to...
Breach a contract? You're assuming they'll breach the contract?
If your business and your livelihood is directly threatened, I don't think that contract's going to be as big of an issue.
Could you have anticipated the need for a nondisclosure?
Well, based on the statute in this particular situation, I would argue no.
Based on the 2015 experience? Or based on prior experiences, let's just say? That you said there's pressure on suppliers, and you know that when you contract with them.
Right. I mean, there's... Yes. I mean, you could anticipate that may occur. But if you're in that situation and your livelihood is being threatened, I'm not sure that a contract provision is really going to stop anything with a supplier.
So you're saying even if you had a non-disclosure, they would have violated it. You could anticipate they'll violate it, so no, don't bother. I mean, I don't understand the answer. I beg your pardon.
Sure. I mean, it's speculation. And so it gets back to the fundamental problem in this case right here, which is during the case in chief for the requesting parties, they didn't present any evidence, right? And so they presented some evidence, but it had nothing to do with the question before the court on whether or not these were public records. So that put...
Well, they presented evidence that they were citizens or asking for documents. They asked for documents that are by definition public record, an invoice. Isn't that a public record?
No, but again...
agreement, isn't that a public record by
again,
definition?
None of that kicks in if the other statute exception applies. And so both 712 and 712.01, I'm paraphrasing, but they basically say nothing else in this act applies if you have another statute exception.
So this argument is this correct? That fundamental is to your argument is this is an exception, not an exemption.
Correct.
Is exempt in the statute upon which you rely? Is the word exempt in there?
The word exempt is there, but the legislature uses different
okay.
terms.
What did we say in Axmit about this situation about public records? Do you recall? Do they remain public records?
So what I remember from Axmit is this court said it wouldn't hesitate to apply the other statute exception if it existed.
And I think that we said that the public body must show by clear and convincing evidence that public record is exempt.
Right.
Is that relevant?
So there's two
paths. So you're saying that's not relevant because you're not even on the exempt track. You're on the exception track.
Correct.
Is that it?
The legislature knows how to do this. If they want to put the burden on the public body, they put it in, I believe it's 0.05.
But don't they know how to do this by saying all suppliers, all pharmaceutical companies are part of the execution team? Is that one way to do this, and did they choose that way? Flat out deny that opportunity?
Well, that question actually, when it came up during floor debate on this bill, the introducer of the bill says, if it's your job as a contractor, your job to deliver the drugs, you should not have your name released.
Okay, but that's not in the specific statute, is it?
No, but they were talking about why they wanted the second clause in the statute and not just the first clause about the execution
team
members.
And then later, didn't the legislature consider this specific issue? Wasn't a bill presented and considered?
That is correct. But
what happened to that bill?
That bill did not pass. It was a much more expansive version. It would apply to all situations. It applied to medical suppliers of equipment.
It made them part of the execution team, correct?
I don't remember that specific, but I don't have a reason to dispute that. It was very expansive. This application here is narrow. Frakes is arguing that it's narrow, which is the difference between the 2015 example and the present example. If the testimony at trial did not show this connection, we wouldn't have an argument. But the testimony at trial did show this connection.
Frakes' testimony that the supplier knew a member of the execution team, is that the specific testimony you're referring to?
Yes.
Or that it will lead to the identity of a team member.
There's testimony on both issues.
So how should we define that phrase, any information reasonably calculated to lead to the identity of such members? You seem to be suggesting that good investigative journalism is reasonably likely to lead to the information. I'm trying to understand that argument.
So this phrase isn't new. Reasonably calculated is used in the Nebraska discovery rules. It's been interpreted incredibly broadly in those rules. It probably came from the federal rules. As it was used in the federal rules, the federal court said it was so broad, we're going to take that language out. In the case of Nebraska, we have a case, Stetson v. Silverman, 278 Nebraska, 389. There you have a plaintiff with a medical malpractice case, and the court talks about a lot of things, but it basically says that you could go get discovery on an investigatory matter on sexual assault, even though the medical malpractice plaintiff wasn't alleging sexual assault, because almost anything was reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. And so this court has already said that that phrase is incredibly broad. And there's one other statute I want to reference real quick. This public record statute is not the only one that uses this type of language. So another one is 71-3507, which I know it's a different issue, but it says information that is likely to present a clear threat to the security of radioactive material. This language is used in the Records Act. And again, if we hand that key over, the question really is it conceivable that the person who receives the key isn't going to open the door?
So let me see with some specific examples within the case. There are what I'll call primary documents, that the document would name a team member, right, that you wouldn't want disclosed.
Correct.
Okay, and then there'll be what I'll call maybe secondary. It would be a document with the supplier, right, and you don't want those disclosed because the supplier could reveal a team member with whom it's dealing, is that right?
In this instance, I'm not saying it would apply to everyone, but in this one, yes.
In this example. So how does that apply to the inventory log?
So
is that not a tertiary document? It doesn't have a team member and it doesn't have a supplier. So why do you apply that analysis to the inventory log?
Without disclosing the entire content, there is information on the inventory log identifying the supplier.
So that was that the testimony or was the testimony the contrary?
I don't remember that specific testimony right at this time.
So if the inventory log doesn't have the face of the supplier and it doesn't have a team member, then would it be something that should be produced?
I still say no, because the same path still gets you there. As soon as you have this inventory log...
Now, what if we were on the other path, just for hypothetical sense?
Which path? I'm sorry.
Exemption.
If you were on the exemption, the public body would have to prove, and if this is an exemption statute, I don't believe, at least for the inventory log, we...
It's not working with your primary argument. I understand okay.
I'll end with this, then I would like to save some time for rebuttal. I don't know how else the legislature could have written this statute if they didn't want the record statutes to apply. They've used this language repeatedly, and if I may, I'd like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. So Mr. Eichel?
Yes.
Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court, Christopher Eichel appearing on behalf of the Pelley, Amy Miller, and ACLU of Nebraska Foundation, asking the court to affirm the district court and ordering Director Frakes to produce the records relating to communications with the execution drug suppliers as requested by Ms. Miller on October 27, 2017. This case does turn on the interpretation of 83-967, and as Mr. Post said, the legislature does know how to do this, and they have not, the legislature has not provided for the exemption of the identity of the drug supplier. This exception-exemption distinction that Mr. Post is suggesting the court adopt, I would respectfully
Mr.
argue...
Mr. Eichel, I'm going to stop you for a second. Are you dividing your time with Mr.
Yes,
Renner?
I'm sorry, I should have explained before. I'm dividing my time, 7.5 minutes for me, and Mr. Renner will have the balance of the time.
Okay.
The exemption-exception distinction is something that the appellant is suggesting this court adopt. I would point the court to an earlier public records case, Adam County versus Kenyon, in which the court balanced an exception statute, or the exceptions of 84.712.01 versus another statute. The case in Adams County dealt with whether the Hastings Regional Center records relating to people who were buried in the cemetery there were considered medical records as exempted by another statute in a different chapter. This court read that in conjunction with the exception in the Public Records Act that records relating to death records are not are considered public records. So I gave that, this is an example, that this court has never recognized any sort of outside Chapter 84 exception or burden of proof or anything like that. The issue is whether...
Well, doesn't this all come down to burden of proof?
It does. And...
Have we spoken on that already?
You have. The burden of proof is on the public body to prove by clear and convincing evidence to justify or to justify sustain its reason for withholding the records.
Isn't that only applicable, haven't we said that's applicable when you're in the open records statute regime?
That's right.
If you're not in the open records statute regime, we've never said how that applies, have we?
Perhaps not framing that question in that way, you haven't, but we would submit that we have established standing. We only need to show a prima facie case. We are a citizen or a party interested. We've been denied requests.
That goes back to, are you in the open records regime? If you're not, aren't you in an entirely different position?
You might, but we'd argue we are in the open records regime. There
I understand. That's statute. Fundamental to your...
That is fundamental.
I'd like to shift for a second to ask a question about the statutory language of reasonably calculated. If you look at that in the context of the current Nebraska discovery rule and the former federal discovery rule, there were a lot of cases, weren't there, that said reasonably calculated means any possibility it could lead to that. Why shouldn't we interpret the language of this statute in that fashion?
The reason is that pretrial discovery is meant to be all-encompassing for judicial economy, for judicial efficiency, for fact-finding, for purposes of proving and litigating cases. It's meant to be broad. This is a narrow exception or a limitation to the disclosure of records that the public is entitled to have access to.
What makes you think it's narrow when the legislature chose? It's not as if this is a statutory interpretation that we've applied. The legislature chose the language reasonably calculated.
It did.
Why do you characterize that as narrow?
Because I think it's this court's precedent to interpret that as narrow. When you look at an exception or an exemption or whatever you want to call it to the Public Records Act, that term, if it's subject to different readings, is always interpreted narrowly. That's consistent with the six or eight cases that we discussed.
But that's true when we've talked about what's in 84-712.05.
Right.
We've said that with respect to those types of records that need not be produced. But have we ever said that in the context of other statutes?
I think you did in the Kenyon case, and that dealt with the HIPAA federal law and a couple of state statutes to deal with medical records. Those were interpreted narrowly as well. That same standard of interpretation applied in those cases.
Now, that's an interesting case because you have death records that are explicitly mentioned in the open records statute, and here we don't have these sort of records specifically identified in the open records statute, do we?
By record, just so I understand the question, meaning identifying
The language in the Adams County case, it was they were contrasting what HIPAA said with what our open records statute said, and it had language in 84.712.05 that expressly talked about records of deaths.
That's right. That's true. We don't have anything in 84, in Chapter 84, that deliberately or that directly relates to an execution team member or the Department of Correctional Services, but as a practical matter, government operates in all sorts of different ways in all sorts of different chapters. I would respectfully suggest that shouldn't matter. We can't simply have a narrative list in Chapter 84 of everything that may be exempted or accepted or whatever in another series of statutes.
I had asked questions of the state, Mr. Frakes, that counsel, that when you are getting to layers and following up with Justice Castle's question, broad or narrow, how even if narrow or even if broad, how much information must be on the face of a document to conclude it should be produced?
It's difficult to answer that question because, as the trial court held in this case, the claim is speculative. speculative at best. If you look at the factual basis here, and the factual findings are not clearly erroneous, when Director Freitas was asked at trial if there was any part of the contract or agreement or understanding or any similar arrangement they had with the supplier to not reveal the identity of an execution team member, he first seemed surprised by the question and then eventually said no. So it's not reasonable for him to have that concern that whatever may be discovered or disclosed
on the face. So reasonably calculated is the language of the statute. So
right.
Go back to my example then, or the hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Documents on their face may have the name of a team member.
Right.
I think that's the testimony.
Right.
And then documents on their face, or rather would have the name of a supplier.
Right.
Not on their face team member, but it would have a supplier. Right. And then I think, according to the testimony with respect to the inventory log, I believe there's no testimony that it's on the face of a team member or the supplier. So now that's a tertiary.
Right.
What's your response to a document like that under the statute?
I think then that's just speculation. I think that's a broad reading of the statute. If the standard is what could possibly leave in a first, second, or third step,
right.
I'd argue that that is something that is inconsistent with, of course, earlier decisions regarding acceptance
so
of the
my reading of the record could be incorrect, but if that's the case, we have layers.
You do have layers. And the court made that finding between records on their face that had an execution team member on his face or on their face versus ones that may lead to the discovery.
So the trial court used the word speculative as to some things.
Right. As to anything that did not have an execution team member's identity on its face, the court held that the claim that the other documents could lead to the identity of a team member as speculative. I'd like to save the rest of my time for my companion counsel.
Thank you very much. Mr. Renner, good morning to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. I'd like to pick up where this last thread of argument left off, if I may. Justice Castle, I don't think it's fair to say that the Kenyon case is different because that had a reference in one of the exemptions under 0.05.
Well, it did,
but we do it here too, is my point. 83.712.03 is the section of the Public Records Act that talks about procedure in a mandamus case and a Public Records Act case. It does several things and are here. Two methods, mandamus action, petition the Attorney General. Petitioning the Attorney General wouldn't have done much good here. Subsection 2 says, when the suit is filed under this section, so a Public Records Act mandamus case, court has jurisdiction to do a variety of things. It then says, the court shall determine the matter de novo, and the burden is on the public body to sustain its action. That's how you think about a mandamus Public Records Act case. The burden is always on the public body to sustain its action. Doesn't matter whether you're talking about an exception or an exemption to the extent there's a difference between the two. It goes on to say in 0.01.
But that's the underlying premise behind that argument is that the open records statutes apply to the particular subject matter that we're talking about.
Yes.
And if, just saying if, the exception, or whatever you want to call it, in 83-967 takes it completely out of the open records context, then how do we reach the conclusion that you're urging?
And the point I want to try to make is you mentioned in the Kenyon case there was a reference in one of the exemptions that kept this within the Public Records Act case, I guess is how it, or statute is how I'd describe it. That's true here also. In fact, we asked for public records as they're defined by the statute. Section 84712.01, which contains the except as otherwise provided language, in subsection 3 says, Sections 84712 to 0.03 shall be liberally construed whenever any state, county, etc. fiscal records, voucher, invoice, purchase order, requisition, payroll check, etc. Those are all identified as public records in the public records statute. That's what the reporters asked for here, was those records.
That goes back, I think the premise of your opponent is we're not in the open records context at all. Your premise is, oh yes we are, but certain things don't have to be disclosed. Isn't that a fair characterization of the parties' positions?
I think it is. And if you go back to the very first time this court addressed procedure in a Public Records Act case, and that would have been the Nebraska Health Association case in 1998, this Girard opinion, and what he said was, here's how we view the procedure. And he said, the relator has the burden to prove both standing and a prima facie case that leads to the language that you're talking about. Clearly the standing can't be right. You just decided Griffin 2 weeks ago in the context of the same execution protocol, and you said standing is, do you have the right plaintiff for the case, and it's not a function of can you prove the merits or not. And that's what we're being asked to do here, is prove the merits up front as a function of standing.
Your argument is the burden doesn't shift.
The burden does not shift, that's right. The statute tells you why it doesn't. It's always on the party that has the information to prove it. With specific regard to this claim that I can withhold anything that has an identity of a drug supplier, let's look at the chronology of how that argument has gone.
Well, the identity of the execution team member, that's the first clause of this.
It is, and the second one is reasonably calculated.
Reasonably calculated.
Yep. That comes from 2009. 2008, the court holds electrocution unconstitutional. 2009, the legislature enacts LB 36, which creates lethal injection, creates the execution protocol. This is all in the record, and it's all laid out there. Started out, all of that was going to be secret and closed. The execution protocol was a secret document. There were objections. Speaker Flood's passage in my brief mentions the agreement with me in Nebraska that no, we're going to keep this to be an open process. 967 was passed as part of that bill. From 2009 until 2016, the record shows record requests were repeatedly made for exactly these documents, repeatedly given to the news media by the governor, by the attorney general, and by the Department of Corrections, exactly the documents we're talking about here. August 2016, Ms. Miller makes a request on behalf of ACLU for all the same documents she'd been requesting previous years. That's Exhibit 10 of the record, and it has every category of documents that are being asked for here. The department didn't say, we object, this is reasonably calculated to lead to an execution team member. It said, here, have the documents. You can have them. 2 months later, it started a APA proceeding to amend the protocol to make the identity of a drug supplier confidential as part of the protocol. It didn't do that because it determined it lacked the authority to do it. So when you read the current protocol, it doesn't say that. 2 months after that, they went to the legislature and said, we need a statute that says the drug supplier's identity is confidential. And when they did that, look at the legislative history. It's in exhibit number 5. They didn't say, we need this because someone might identify an execution team member. They said, we need this because somebody might harass a drug supplier and we need drugs. The mention of identifying an execution team member does not show up in that legislative history, and the legislature chose not to pass that statute. They didn't enact it. That tells you whether or not the identity of an execution team member is reasonably calculated, because that statute existed, the department came back and said, we need this change in the statute to make our execution system work, and the legislature didn't do it. It's not up to the Attorney General's office, it's not up to Director Frakes, and I'm sorry, but it's not up to this court to override that legislative determination. The legislative history couldn't be clearer that identity of the execution drug supplier is not confidential in Nebraska, period.
Of course, we only look to legislative history if there's ambiguity in the statutory text.
And we just spent some time talking about what is reasonably calculated. There is some ambiguity, apparently, about what's reasonably calculated. We know that the legislature twice declined to make a statute that says execution drug supplier identity is secret. You can't square that with the idea that a statute that has been in existence for 10 years and has never been thought to mean what it now means by the own department. I mean, we've got the governor, we've got the attorney general, we've got the Department of Corrections providing all these records up until it came crunch time. And they said, oh, we've changed our minds. It's no longer a public record. And now the argument is, it's your burden, news media, to show that it is a public record when you don't know what these documents are, other than what we've previously given you, that clearly they thought were public records, or they wouldn't have provided them. You can't make that legislative history work in the context of the statute. I see my time's up.
I have another question for you, if I may. There's a question about redacting the records.
Correct.
We don't have the records in our record, do we? We don't know what those records are?
We do not. They have not provided them to them.
How could we redact them?
No, it would be Frakes that would redact them. It would be the Department of Corrections.
How do we order them to redact them?
Under the statute, it says that's 0.07 in the public records statute, and it gives a very express reference. It says where there is a record, a purchase order, an invoice that's designated as a public record by the statute that contains information that is confidential, you're required to take out that confidential information and provide the rest of it. How much did it cost? What kind of drugs is it?
Would the sub-2 provisions for protection order?
What's that?
Would the 967 sub-2 be the statutory vehicle for redacting or protecting?
No, it's in
orders.
The Public Records Act itself. The okay. Public Records Act says when, and I think it's 0.07, I may have the number wrong, but it's okay. One of the series there. It's a single sentence, and it says where you've got a record that contains both public information and confidential information, the answer in the public records statute is to take a Sharpie and cross out the identity.
So you're, what, under 712.06 production minus portion language.
And that makes sense.
Is that where you're referring to?
On the redaction,
it's
sure.
Doable in your view under that.
Yeah.
That, of course, assumes that we're in the open records
if we're in the
framework.
You know, if you look at, there are three cases that deal with what we're calling other statutes that this court has decided. Not a single one of them says in any concrete way in the analysis that who has the burden of proof. You've got Kinyon, the Adams County Historical Society case in which Chief Justice Hevekin's opinion says, here's the Records Act, here's HIPAA, here are three state privacy statutes. As a matter of statutory construction, we look at all this together and we harmonize it. That's a pretty standard canon of statutory construction. And when we do that, we find that these are public records and you release them. We then have, that's 2009, I believe, you then have Unger. And Unger is a pretty straightforward other exception case. I want a pre-sentence investigation. Pre-sentence investigations are privileged. No doubt about what that is. But you look at the court's opinion, it doesn't say that Unger loses because Unger didn't make a prima facie case, or Unger loses because the court lacks jurisdiction even to decide the case, which would be a standing argument. It says, as a matter of statutory construction, you ask for a PSI, you can't have a PSI. You get to Vesterna as the third one. These are the only three cases where this other exception has come up, and Vesterna's analysis is real similar. The Attorney General there made the argument, there's this statute that says you can make rules that make JBE records confidential.
But there weren't any
rules. That's a little bit of a problem in that context. But look what the court didn't say. The court didn't say, we lack standing to decide this issue. The court did not say, Dr. Vesterna, you failed to carry your prima facie case. The court said, we're looking at the statutes and we're construing them, and when you do that, this is not a statute that provides an exception here. If you use exactly that mode of analysis here, the media and ACLU win. And that's the only mode of analysis you've ever used. I've taken way too much of my time. I'm sorry about that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
2 minutes and 30 seconds. Mr. Post.
Thank you. Three quick points. First, the argument under 712.03 doesn't work. The very first sentence of the 0.03 statute says, if your rights have been denied under the statutes. So that gets back to the threshold issue in the case. Second, the case law actually has been very consistent on this burden question of whose burden it is on the first three elements. And I know we're only debating the second two, but Nebraska Healthcare, Evertson, Kinyon, Axmit, Vesterna, Unger, every single one of them repeats the exact same principle, which is it is the requesting party's burden to show they are requesting public records. Now, most of those cases were not other statute exception cases, which is why the court doesn't talk about our argument here today, because they didn't have to. That's not what was at issue there. But when the court had the opportunity in Unger, it took it and it said privileged and not disclosed is another statute exception. Here, our language says confidential and not disclosed, and actually goes a step further, and it says not disclosed under the record statutes. It cites them directly, and it lists the whole breadth of the statute. And so
is this even a fair question? It's not a public record if it's exempted or accepted?
So if it is accepted, it is not a public record. If it is exempted, it is a public record, but then it's the public's body to prove why the exemptions in 0.05
apply. So is this your argument there's a shifting burden if we go into this other statute?
Yes, and that burden comes from, I mean, this is a mandamus action, right? And so that burden flows from that. has to be a clear legal duty. And I would even argue it has to be clear and convincing from the requester's side. The Nebraska healthcare decision talks about that. That's not an issue here, because what's fairly unique about this case, and I'll tell you, I was amazed at trial, was there was no evidence at all during the prima facie case, which is why you'll see in the record, I made a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. That is based on every single one of this court's public records cases since Nebraska healthcare, where it spells out that on those three elements, that you're requesting party, it's a public record, and you were denied. On all three of those, it is the requesting party's burden. There's another question on some of the inventory logs. One thing I wanted to address there was that some inventory logs, I believe, were released. And that, again, shows the distinction that was made here. The ones that were not released are the ones that link to the supplier. And so, but that entire discussion, though, again, assumes it was even the state's burden to prove anything during the trial.
Counsel, does it matter to your argument that 83-967 doesn't speak in terms of records at all? It focuses on particular information. Is that focus of the statute significant to our analysis?
I actually think it helps, because if it was trying to list an exhaustive list, and then in this example doesn't list rosters, that would be a problem, right? They're trying to keep this information from being released.
The identity information.
The identity and, the second clause, information reasonably calculated to lead to the identity. So let's think about it through the lens of Unger, right? Everybody wants to talk about Unger as a PSI case. In the Unger case, we were actually talking about a questionnaire. Now, the argument from the government was the questionnaire was part of the PSI, but questionnaire wasn't listed as being confidential. I don't believe the word questionnaire shows up in that statute at all. But in that instance, the burden was still on, under the statute, it was still on the requesting party to show that it either wasn't another statute exception, or maybe that the questionnaire wasn't part of the PSI, or something along those lines. And so it's convenient to go with the broad description, right? But when you actually dive into these cases, they're looking at very specific records that have been requested.
To go back to the inventory logs, to correct me if I'm wrong, but Mr. Frakes testified that the inventory logs, quote, contain information that would allow someone to ultimately find out who the supplier was. So that's why I was saying perhaps that's a tertiary document if we get that far in the analysis. But you're saying regardless of the testimony, some inventory logs were produced. Is that the fact in the record?
I would have to go through the Bill of Exceptions to check. I believe the initial response, the response letters, as well as the some of the documents that were there were 50 pages of documents produced that today makes it sound like nothing was produced. There were 50 pages, and I would have to go through those again.
Okay, thank you.
When
the record is the record, so thank you. Yes.
I believe. I would have to check, though.
Thank you.
There's been some arguments made that the failed legislative attempt is somehow legislative history. In that failed legislative attempt that occurred regarding this matter, did that go to an up-down vote of the entire legislature, or did that get out of committee?
I don't believe it got out of committee.
Okay. Thank you.
If I may conclude very briefly, the legislature and this court have consistently provided a roadmap for the requesting parties on how the other statute exception works. The appellees skipped that step. The district court order should be vacated and remanded with direction to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next case of the day, then, is Lloyd versus Family Dollar Stores of Nebraska. Papik has rejoined the court. Mr. Meister, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Justice.